We'll save perhaps a little more formal introduction before the panel, but just very briefly, Rabbi Dr. Aleph is the academic dean of Skokie Yeshiva in Chicago and a professor of American history, Jewish history at Atura College. I'm Avakasha, without further ado.
Thank you, Rabbi Kamel. Thank you to all of you for coming. I've been in Toronto for 48 hours, and I think I've seen the entire swath of potential weather. I've seen much of Toronto in a short amount of time. What I want to look at with you is something that we'll call a myth. I'm not interested in debunking the myth, but I want to look at a foundational story, a narrative that was used by a particular community to understand and to give license to their resettlement in the New World, in North America, and to give themselves a mission, a purpose at a critical moment in Jewish history. So what am I talking about? So everybody has this source sheet, right? No. There are source sheets right outside. Why don't we just take a quick moment, maybe bring them all in. We'll pause for just a second. Over here, great. So if you take a look at the very back of this packet, I've reproduced for you the preface, the very first page, in a work, a very interesting work, a coffee table book, but fascinating, The World That Was. There's a whole series produced by the Hebrew Academy of Cleveland. The World That Was, in this volume, has to do with America, 1900 to 1945. And if you look to the back page, it begins, it was approximately 200 years ago when the Vilna Gaon's primary disciple, Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, who at the time was laying the cornerstone for his preeminent yeshiva in Volozhin, Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in Volozhin, founded in 1802. Where he called attention to the potential sanctuary for Torah that lay across the ocean. So here is Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, the founder of the entire yeshiva movement at the very beginning of the 19th century, who is laying the cornerstone for his, what will become a famed yeshiva in Eastern Europe. And already he is suggesting that this is in the future. Let me tell you, across the world, there are these chaps named Thomas Jefferson. George Washington has just passed away. James Madison. There are approximately 1,000 Jews in what is the United States, a smattering and eventually in a community that's just emerging in Montreal as well. And let me tell you, while I'm establishing the Volozhin Yeshiva, that the future of Torah is in the New World in America. Reb Chaim shed tears. Tears that were mistaken as tears of joy, but were really tears of grief. No, said Reb Chaim, I cry out of sadness. Were Volozhin to be the last station for Torah's wanderings before the advent of Mashiach, I would cry for joy. Unfortunately, said Reb Chaim, the Torah is destined to wander further to the wilds of America before Mashiach Tikenu arrives, and who can tell how many thousands of Jews will be lost to our people in America. So imagine that. Reb Chaim Volozhin is about to establish a revolution in the Olam HaYeshiva. The first modern-day yeshiva, not with a dormitory, but with a housing project, a curriculum that is rather innovative, and he's telling everybody, with tears streaming down his face, that don't mistake in this moment, This is transitory. Really, Torah is going to migrate to America, and it's going to be there that Mashiach is going to arrive in the Chiddush.
What year was that?
Excuse me?
What year was it?
This is 1802. There are 1,000 Jews in America. Very hard for Eastern Europeans to know much about what America means. There are no real Jewish newspapers in earnest. So what little Reb Chaim Volozhiner has in his knowledge base of America, he is certain that America will one day become a Torah center. And from there, only once Torah is ensconced in the New World will Mashiach arrive. It's incredible. Take a look at the first page. So that document was a preface to a book published in 2004. The very first source that I know of this narrative, of this foundational story, appeared in 1937. Take a look at source one. Published in Yiddish, in Hebrew, and in English. L'magenet liv. I'm looking at the Hebrew. Nimnu ha'gdolem ha'manhigim ha'akshir ba'ofen ma'asi et asher chaza me'rosh gon ha'dor ha'chaim v'rosh. It is regrettable, I'm in source one, that some of the great leaders refrained from legitimizing what Reb Chaim of Volozhin had predicted over a century ago. This is a text authored by Rabbi Moshe Yosher, a biography, a multi-volume biography of the Chafetz Chaim, who published two volumes called Nidchei Yisrael at the very end of the 19th century, instructing his readers not to go to America. So here in this section on the Chafetz Chaim's position on migration to America, Rabbi Yosha can't help himself but say, you know what? Not necessarily they were complicit, but oy, that the rabbinic elites in Eastern Europe did not recommend that their followers resettle in the United States. And how not only did they not do that, but apparently in 1937 he was well aware, and he clues you in that he's aware. May Rosh Ka'ona Dora Chaim Volozhin, with May Lamala, Mimei Hashana. Were they not aware? All of the rabbis of Eastern Europe said, do not go to that Treif in the Medina. Some people call it a golden a Medina, but many of the rabbinic elites preferred Treifin a Medina in the New World. It's a shame, not irresponsible, but a shame, writes this author, that they did not recommend more strongly or at all that Jews consider migrating to the United States. Ki America tevet l'merkaz shel yadut. Because America, according to Reb Chaim Volozhiner, would transform into a center of Torah. Teams of America at Asanya. Because apparently there are going to be 10 migrations, 10 exiles, and America will be the last Shayala Lavor, Lifne Misore. Because there's something of a source in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, La'achar Shekvar Avra et Ha'artzot, and Torah before Mashiach will come will travel 10 places, and he tells you what they are. Bavel, Africa, Mitzrayim, Italia, Sfard, Tsarfat, Germany, France, Ashkenaz, Poland, Velita. Torah is going to travel in all of these 10 locales between the closing of the Talmud and the arrival of Mashiach. Yala Abigorala Shel America. But its final place, its final destination will be America, Liyot Atsanya, America's Achronim LaTorah. And it will be the last station of Torah before Mashiach. It was predestined. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent George Washington, Christopher Columbus, Amerigo Vespucci to the New World so that Mashiach would be able to arrive after it's been settled, after Torah can stake a flag in this New World, then Mashiach will arrive. This is 1937. This is the most original. This is the fourth source that I know of, and it's written down. Of course, that doesn't mean that people didn't know it. In fact, Rabbi Yosha is not telling you the entire story, which makes me think that he presumes that his readers know a little bit about it. Right? If I'm writing and I refer, if I call a basketball team a Cinderella team, a Cinderella story, I don't need to tell you the entire fairy tale of Cinderella for you to understand that that's a team that's going from rags to riches, that they're the underdog of it all. You are already initiated into that cultural mythos. You know that. So this story, you don't get the whole story about Reb Chaim and establishing Belushin and crying. The author presumes a certain level of knowledge. So it's in the air by 1937. Take a look in source 2. We maybe should turn this off. I don't know. We'll try it one more time. If it's all right with you, I'm a little bit shell-shocked. I'll turn this off.
There won't be recorded.
Yeah, then you're not going to get it recorded.
Maybe I'm trying to record it.
Okay. So I will try. I will persist. Okay. Rabbi Abba Zantz, an interesting rabbinic figure, writes an article in Hapardes, an American rabbinic journal, and he refers. He says it's Rami.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm weighing the benefits of this being taped for posterity and for us to communicate and enjoy one another this morning. Rabbi Zanz writes the following, Zichroni is in source 2. V'hinei harav teretz agona based in Deutsch. So he's quoting from somebody else. Nimza az b'tchilat melchamat ha'olam ha'shniya b'brisk. And recording that they were in Brisk with the Brisker Rav. Patach v'amar b'divrei maran agon harav atzadik v'yuruchlam ha'levi l'vavitz b'shem agon r'pchaim v'lajna. So he's recording the story in 1947. Who haya omer asher b'kivta d'mashicha tzricha Torah ot liyot b'gilusa achora b'America. That Mashiach can only come once Torah arrives in America. V'hizkir agon l'chaim zot ga'eb b'dachia. He said this while crying uncontrollably. V'yamim ahim lo havininu adayim pesher hagava. We didn't really understand in the early 19th century what Reb Chaim and his prophecy really entailed. Gam ech ukeitza yitzor talitza, how this would come about. How did Torah come to America? Referring to in 1947 is that Reb Chaim Belozer in understanding how Torah would migrate to the New World, it would take a Holocaust for it to take place. If you look at the preface, again, why did this author suggest that Torah would migrate to America? It doesn't say, but the crying had to do with the cost-benefit of living in America. Reb Chaim's tears, presumably, are because of the threat of assimilation. There are many Jews who are going to be lost in the wild climes of the New World, and that is why he cried. According to this version of the story in Source 2, it was because of the Shoah. It's because of 6 million souls that were lost, but Totzeniza, that the result of that was the migration of Torah forcibly out of a sanctuary in North America. Take a look at page five in the source. There's a little, they're numbered at the very bottom. I'm not sure how well known the story was, because you have the first Rung, for example, who wrote a memoir, Canadian rabbinic elite, a very important Talmud Chacham in Canada.
Now translated into English, just now.
It was just translated into English, exactly right. Exactly, I'm very happy to see those. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy yet. But the Veil of Tears was just translated a couple of years ago. Right, very important. Yes, yes, absolutely right. And he records a story, but he heard it from none other than Reb Chaim Ozer. Reb Chaim Ozer told him the story, but as Reb Pinchas Hirschman, who had a terrific memory by all accounts, somehow, when he put it down onto paper, it wasn't told in the name of Reb Chaim of Volozha, but rather, if you take a look, there's an ellipsis, on the top of the page, it's the first full paragraph. Who is the story? For whom is the story told? It's not Reb Chaim of Volozhin, but it's told as Reb Chaim Brisker. Now, there are two Reb Chaims, each one has a valuable place in modern rabbinic history, but I can tell you, there's no way that Reb Pinchas Hirschsprung mistaken Reb Chaim of Volozhin, who founded the Volozhin Yeshiva in the early 19th century, with Reb Chaim Brisker, who would become Rosh Yeshiva there much later around the turn of the 20th century. Both Rabbi Chaims, but anybody who is initiated into the world of Torah learning doesn't mistake in one with the other. If that's the case, then perhaps this story wasn't as well known, because obviously, to me at least, is that for a Chaim Volozhiner to be the protagonist or the teller in this story is far more meaningful in 1802 than it would be for Reb Chaim Brisker, who died around the end of World War I, in 1918. That's a different type of America. Does that make sense? What that tells me is that if Reb Hirschsprung is recording the story differently, then the story isn't exactly as well known in rabbinic circles, but it also tells me that Reb Chaim Ozer is telling the story, and to connect rabbis to him is quite interesting, especially if you turn the page. If you turn the page, here is it's called Rabban Shel Yisrael on the top left. I only want to look at it for a moment. Reb Chaim Ozer are actually paskin based on this movie. He was very involved in helping obtain visas for rabbis to travel to America. What was that all about? Is that after 1924, particularly in the United States, there was legislation passed which essentially limited migration to America to a trickle for Eastern Europeans and they more or less targeted Eastern European Jews. But there was one clause, Clause 4D, in the immigration law, which allowed ministers and professors to be exempt if they had the appropriate visas. So rabbis were still permitted, if they had the appropriate paperwork, to migrate to the United States even after migration was curtailed in 1924. If you think about it, that clause was absolutely transformative. If you think about all the people who leveraged that clause between Rabbi Soloveitchik, Lubav Chalevi, Robert Cutler, Rebecca Kamenetsky, Moshe Feinstein, Ruderman, Hirschberg. If you think about all those people, if you had to assemble a hall of fame of North American rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, all of them, nearly all of them, with the exception of maybe Rabbi Eliezer Silver of Cincinnati, would have to make use of a clause that was really, really meant to help European-trained Christian, Protestant ministers and Catholic priests, because they had better seminaries for certain denominations in Europe. So they put this clause in to allow for them to have an exception to migrate to America. But in so doing, it helped transform the Orthodox rabbi. So Reb Chaim Ozer was incredibly supportive and helpful in obtaining the paperwork for rabbis. And he was asked, in this source, you see the story that's told, that was asked, who should we bring in? Should we bring an established Russian, if we have one visa left, there's still a limit. If we have enough time to prepare the paperwork for an established rabbinic elite or a young rabbi with who exercises certain levels of promise and potential, but not necessarily an established rabbi, who should we elect? That's the question he was asked. And so he postulated. It's right here on, it's a kufsan with that on the top. He postulated that, well, wait a second, Reb Chaim Ozer already prophesied that it was America that was supposed to be a Torah center. Well, who's better for cultivating a Torah center? It must be the established rabbi who needs to come and needs to write rabbinic novelet, not necessarily the rabbi who was younger, who has potential, not there yet, but would be helpful maybe in education, but wouldn't it be as helpful in right now establishing the Torah Center? And so we postulate based on climate pleasure and vision. So who exercised, who really made, popularized this story? Take a look. Actually, before we take a look at source 3, take a look at page 3 in the handout. And much thanks to Rabbi Moshe Kulani and the Yehuda Archives for furnishing this for me. This, what you're looking at, it looks something like chicken scratch, but it's quasi-legible. And it was certainly legible enough for its author, Rav Aaron Kahn, who arrives in America in San Francisco in 1940. And he had his prepared remarks. There was a whole delegation there to greet Rav Aaron Cutler, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Klotz, who's already well known. He comes to America, and even Rabbi Eliezer Silver from Cincinnati travels all the way to the Bay Area to greet him. The Jews of San Francisco, a substantial community, welcome him at the pier, and he knows that, and he has remarks for what his purpose is going to be, his mission in the United States of America. And here are his notes, and here's what he said in more legible typed rendition in source 3. Motelet alim, source 3. Hachova la'aso kekol yecholatina, we have to do everything in our capacity, says Rabbi Kahler. Almanat l'toa, to plant et ohalei ha'torah b'tzibyonan, to cultivate, in source 3. To build the tents of Torah in this place, b'dimotan, in its image, u'b'komotan, in its measure, u'muleim, u'mukurayim, to make it exactly the way I left it in Eastern Europe, and to transplant, and to build it in America. Kam be'eretz, to do whatever it is I was able to do, or whatever we, says Motel HaTalim, We got to do it here in America. We got to transplant Europe, European Torah, in America. Umimena Yitkoni, co-beat Israel. We got to do it together. Ukamoshe Yodea, it's well known, says Aaron Cutler. Mishmei Dago Reb Chaim, mi Belashen. He's making sure that nobody mistakes him for Reb Chaim Risker. On the Didas HaTorah Be'Esra HaSanir, everybody knows this by 1940. So some people are sure it's well known, other people aren't so sure it's well known. But after Ron Cutler enunciates it, it's well known. Ad Shabbos Shal Mashiach Tzidkin. It's got to be here. B'chaya Achrona, the last encampment is going to be Tiyah America. What's happening here? What is Ramiro Cutler doing with this narrative, with this tale? Again, my business, and we'll do this in a moment, of whether or not it's true. I think it's possible. There's no way to know for sure. What is he doing with this story? Any ideas?
He's making it genuine.
He's making the story genuine. Okay, I like that one. Genuine.
And not to make another YU.
Not certainly not. Although he had a library card and he got his new library for many years. Yes.
Well, he's using it as a call to action to establish a new yeshiva.
It's a call to action. It's also a justification. This is a treatment entity. How can he leave all of his Talmidim and he would spend the next 3 years trying to retrieve all of those Talmidim, many of whom would perish? And he is justified because this is a treatment of Medina. This is not a place for a Torah scholar, but if you have this foundational story, again, when I use the word story or a myth, I don't mean to besmirch it. It could be true. In fact, it might well be true. But this story becomes a foundational narrative for the yeshiva world to justify how they can migrate to this treatment in Medina, to North America, and how they're going to be successful, and why they ought to be successful, and why you, everybody on the docks of San Francisco, are going to support me in this fairly ambitious endeavor. Now, why might this be true? It might be true for the following. Take a look. Sorry to make you flip back and forth. It's page 4. It's with a picture of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. I've reproduced an entire speech that Aaron gave to a Torah Masorah principal program. Don't have time to go through it all, but it's a fascinating text, in which he suggests the following. First of all, how did he know the story? How did he come about the story? I suggest that Chaim Moser Brzezinski is the disseminator of this story for many of the people that he sent to America. But Rabban Soloveitchik, his father actually took use of the clause of King here in 1928. But Rav Aaron Soloveitchik heard the story differently. He heard it differently, he heard it from a different source. How did he hear it? He heard it at his bar mitzvah. Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, the father of both Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and the Rav Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, told that story at Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's bar mitzvah. Where did Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik hear it? Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik heard it at his bar mitzvah at the Volashim Yeshiva. Who told that story at his bar mitzvah? His great-grandfather. His Zayd. Who was that? The Nitziv, the Rosh Hashiva of the Rosh. Where did he hear that story? He heard it from his father-in-law, Rabbi Itzla of the Rosh. And of course, who was from Itzla's father? Reb Chaim of the Rosh. That's a Masorah. That's incredible. So again, it's a game of telephone, but that's a little different than what we've come across so far. But he tells it different. First of all, it's not about Holocaust for him. The crying with Rabbi David Tevela, and it's very dramatic. While one of the disciples asks Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, why are you crying? And he digs a little bit deeper, and he's crying because of all the people in America who are going to suffer through assimilation because of how Torah needs to travel. But what he also does with Baruch Soloveitchik, he tells you when it happened. It happened, it happened not very dramatically when they're laying the cornerstone, but it's at Ishal Shunas Rasha. That sounds rather strange, but apparently Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin used the Shalash Shudas block in his curriculum to deliver a discourse for an hour. for an hour at a time. It was some of the most creative Torah that Reb Chaim Volozhin outputted in his lifetime. And so it's important. Shalsha, this Torah, usually that means something different. Reb Chaim Volozhin, that was serious. Shalsha, this Torah. And in it, according to Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim connected it to something else that he'd become well known for. If you take a look at in the first page, let me share with you the following. Source 4. In his Nefesh HaChaim, published posthumously and prepared in his lifetime, he instructed, the only text that Reb Chaim Volozhin instructed his students to publish. He published in Shar Dalet, the fourth section has to do with his theology of Talmud Torah. And what is it? Abba. Im hayachas v'shalom ha'alom pone l'gam. He theorizes, does Reb Chaim Volozhin, that if there is a moment in the world, a moment in time, temporally, afilu rega achat mamash, there's just one moment, one second, ma'aseh, b'boninut, im segula v'torah ha'kadosha, in which we are bereft, if there isn't one person studying Torah for a single moment, tekef kerega hayukol ha'olamod nechra'alim uni batalim v'metzios legamei chasashem. Somebody needs to be studying Torah. If the Torah, if the world, if there's going to be a moment where somebody isn't hearing or teaching or preaching Torah, then the world is going to collapse on itself. That's what Chaim Volozhin theorizes. And so that's why there has to be Torah everywhere. Torah there, somebody needs to be studying Torah. If it's 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning in Toronto, well, it's got to be daytime somewhere in some other location, and somebody needs to be studying Torah. It needs to be, because Torah cannot, the world needs to be scaffolded by somebody learning Torah. And if it's true temporally in terms of time, it also has to be true physically. Well, that makes a good deal of sense, according to Reb Chaim Volozhin's theory. It makes a good deal of sense then that Torah needs to be spread everywhere. Just like Torah needs to be taught every moment and read and learned and studied every moment of time, the Torah needs to travel to every place. So in the early 19th century, when Reb Chaim Volozhin understands that there is something called the New World and now it's inhabited, and there are these Americans and there are these British who eventually are going to start something called Canada. Well, you know what? If I'm right, says Reb Chaim Volozhin, then Torah's got to come there. I hear a couple of things. I have no idea what the Jewish population is. I have no idea how viable it is. But if I'm right, what I'm about to write in Nefesh HaChaim, when I've already started teaching my students, then as soon as I, Reb Chaim Volozhin, hear about in America, Torah's got to go there as well. And so it's very possible that he articulated the statement, but under very different circumstances, that Aaron Cutler disseminated this teaching as the foundational narrative in the yeshiva world in the post-war period. Take a look then on the next page. Actually, page 7. It became entrenched. Just a quick survey of the literature. Right, in the Gudda Convention with Ruderman, Rashid Lener Yisrael, he writes in the second to last paragraph, it was not from the vantage point of prophecy, but out of recognition of this pattern, that Rabbi Chaim Volozhin tearfully predicted the laying of the cornerstone of the yeshiva in Volozhin in 1803. I think most scholarship, Shaul Stamper will particularly suggest 1802, not 1803, okay, just a year. This will not be the final station of Torah before Mashiach. Torah is yet to flourish in the wilds of the American continent before we come. It needed to be there. The great Rashid of Baltimore, who first travels to Cleveland, then founds his yeshiva in Maryland in 1933, his purpose, his mission, was just, it was fortified because he was carrying out the mission, the vision of Reb Chaim Volozhin. Take a look back on page 2. Again, apologies for having to flip through it. Rabbi David Lifshitz, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University. Interestingly, when I was at YU, I never heard much about this story. Apparently, while Rav Aaron Soloveitchik told the story many, many times. His brother, Rav, I asked many of his disciples, including my teacher, Rabbi Hershel Shaffer, he never heard the story from the Rav, which is interesting. But Rabbi David Lifshitz, another Rosh Yeshiva at YU, and somebody more ensconced and comfortable in the more right-wing Orthodox community, delivered a Hesped, not for Rav Aaron Cutler, but Rabbi Schneer Cutler. And what does he say in the boldest section? He delivers a eulogy for Rabbi Schneer in the 1980s, but he's really speaking about his father, Rav Aaron Cutler. Kishenicharbu, a yeshiva in source 5, the Yemeha Machama, Nahargu had a dole in my Eden Akidosho, Misharmanu, Rak Aaron Akadosh. In the wake of, a play on words, Aaron and Aharon Cutler, all we had left was Rav Aaron Cutler, our donor, Aaron Bala America, Belachim, the Chamta Shel Torah. He fought the good fight on behalf of Torah. La'amid Torah, la'harim karna ba'amer, to establish the yeshiva world in the United States. Mil'achar, mil'chamat ha'olam ha'yishona, but in 1917, 1918, after the First World War, b'chad mikulam alav ola America. We, the burgeoning rabbinic elite, did not want to come to America, even after the devastation caused by World War I. There was severe devastation in Eastern European Jewry. Hamedina Kasha, Shlomo Alatara Volumda. Teachers, people didn't want to come to America. People knew it was still a trade for the Medina. Shamanim, Shenimsa, Rav Owner, Chaim Lubavitcher, Shapan Bechli Atzuma. We knew about the vision of Rav Chaim Lubavitcher. Nichnas Alav, the Nachlas David. It's a typo, it should be Nachlas David, Rav David Tevela. So a student came in, that's one rendition of the story, at Rabba, at Vashal, at Rabba, he asked the teacher, I'm going to Rabchaim, Lama Tabacha, why are you crying, my great teacher, Rabchaim Blasher? I'm going to Rabchaim, the soap you mean, you may go attain it because of the end of our exile. I turned to Galilee, America, because Torah is going to have to travel to America. Doesn't seem this at the laying of the cornerstone, but sometime sometime between 1802 and 1820 when he died, like 18 years, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Lashon. Nipolin, Lita, Ungarin, Tungri, B'chule, B'chule, V'titgala, Gal, HaTorah, La'America, Torah, Reb Chaim says to David Tevela, his student, will have to travel to America, V'ani Bocha, Ala Chorban HaGadol Shachach, Mekzarka, Sheish Milion, HaYudim. And apparently in this telling, Reb Chaim B'lashon knows exactly how many Jews the Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichram, are going to murder. Yahargu Ad Shesherit HaPlita, when the remnants are going to come, Yavola America. And that's only, and who is the person who sets the stage for that? It is Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Take a look at the next source. It's Rabbi Moshe Sher, the head leader of the Yikudas Yisrael for many, many years. He's delivering a eulogy for, actually it's for Guterman in the 1980s, and he also says, we take a look in the third line, he is talking about the legacy of Guterman, who found really the first European yeshiva, Mary Israel, in 1933. He actually precedes Rav Aaron Cutler in the United States, and he talks about Miropa, Vishanut HaKharbona, Hanora Shal Yahadut Miropa. Again, it's not about the assimilation that, according to one version of the story, was the reason for Chaim Blush to cry, for his tears, but it's rather for the Chorban of Europe. It's for the Shoah. I am a gifter in source 7. Says something very similar. This is a transcript that I redacted from a speech that he gave in 1989. Tell, so he was in Cleveland, Rosh Yeshiva in Cleveland, actually American born, European training, but American born. Tells has tried to maintain its tradition on the source 7 as one of the great yeshivas from overseas. The yeshiva there was one of the 5 great Torah centers in Lithuanian Jewry established in 1885. They did a wonderful job overseas, but Hitler brought about the job that had to be done in the United States. A little more.
I doubt whether he had an idea of what his destruction of Drury would lead to. So again, while the morbidity factor is quite high here, what McGifter is suggesting is that we needed something, and it's hard for me to actually say this out loud, but we needed something to catapult American Jewry and to establish this as a Torah center. I keep telling the story. So by the 1980s, the Rosh Yeshiva, long after Rav Kotler dies in 1962, are telling the story over and over and over again. It's become the equivalent of Washington chopping down the cherry tree. It's become all the stories of how of the four captives that establish the Chachmei Tzfar, which banished Jewry. It's a foundational story which justifies, legitimizes, and brings a purpose to what they're doing to their mission in America. I keep telling the story. Reb Chaim Volozhiner once burst out crying. The last station for Torah before the coming of Mashiach will be the United States of America. One of his great disciples asked him, so why does the Rebbe cry? Now he's a Hasidic Rebbe. What is there to cry about? His answer, I see how bitter it will be to create this last station. No one understood what he was talking about. When Hitler, came along, we began to understand what Reb Chaim Volozhiner had in mind. And he gives some interesting numbers, and I've adjusted them for what they really were. And finally, in source 8 is much of the same. What's happening? What's happening in this story? First of all, not a MythBuster. It could, I think it might be. I think I've shown evidence where it might well have been true. What is the story doing in the post-war period? Yes.
This is making me feel very uncomfortable because it seems as if they are misattributing Reb Chaim's so-called prophecy of the Holocaust, which of course he had no idea what was going to take place, and justifying their coming to America in the 30s and 40s and using the Holocaust as a, justification for
it. Well, the Holocaust becomes a usable past, but also to recreate your, remember somebody said over here, not by you, right? Well, what does that mean? What does that mean, not by you? Why you as an Americanized, a great yeshiva, I'm a proud Muslim and graduate of Yeshiva College, but there's no question that there is an acculturation factor in many of the schools, and I'm the provost of the Hebrew Theological College, the Stoke Yeshiva, that too is a historically Americanized yeshiva. When we make the story, when we transform the story into one that invokes a certain level of Holocaust imagery, it propels us to think about the recreation of European yeshivas in America. It's not just the justification for coming to America in the first place, the so-called Treva Medina, but it's also about the propriety of trying to reestablish a Telz. You know, when you ask Rabbi Aaron Cutler, the CEO of Lakewood, for his population numbers, very interesting, he sent me an Excel spreadsheet. Fascinatingly, his numbers don't begin in 1943 with 23 or 24 students. There's a gap between 1941 and 1942, but the spreadsheet actually begins counting the student enrollment at the Beis Medrash Gavoa in 1921. Why? Because Beis Medrash Gavoa, because Lakewood is classic. Because it's a continuation of a European yeshiva. What is Baltimore? What is Mary Israel? It's not a new yeshiva. It's Slobodka. It's something that's been transported. And when you bring the Holocaust into it, well, let me take a step back. When it's about the assimilation of American Jewry, then it's possible that we can fulfill Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner's vision by creating an American yeshiva, the same way that they created Lithuanian yeshivas and Hungarian yeshivas and Egyptian yeshivas, each one in a particular ecosystem. These Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva world were interested in this story, number one, because it justified their purpose in America, but it also zeroed in on the type of yeshiva. They were not interested in America, qua America. They were interested in transplanting Europe to America. The story and then the progression of the story, the transformation of the story, served a purpose, a unique purpose, for a particular type of Orthodox Judaism in North America. The stories that we tell are really, really crucial.
We all have them, our own family stories. But it's not the stories that we tell, but apparently it's also how we tell them. Thanks so much.
Thank you.